It's indeed a privilege and honor for me, a Presbyterian minister, to be speaking at a Unitarian church. And especially since I am a seventh generation descendant from the Reverend Cotton Mather. Those of you that know U.S. history recall that Cotton Mather and his father, Increase Mather, and his father before him, James Mather, a whole dynasty of ministers in Puritan New England, had very definite ideas about who was in and who was out. And I want to apologize that the Unitarians were not considered to be really in. In fact, even Baptists weren't in. Remember, Roger Williams had to skedaddle out of Boston and get up to what is now Rhode Island, because their beliefs were a little heretical. So I appreciate your willingness to take in a straggler, and I hope that this will be an ecumenical milestone today. You may note that my title, which may have been published somewhere, was called Necessary Losses. And I compared the example of Chicken Little, who when the sky was falling down, sort of went to pieces. And the contention in that sermon, which I'm not going to do today because that was a week ago, things have changed, was that loss is the most significant shaping influence in human behavior. It is the thing that colors how we see the world, whether the cup is half full or half empty. In fact, I notice you're going to see the movie Bruce Almighty on Tuesday, and using that prism as a lens, you might note when you see that film what the importance of loss is for Bruce and how God takes pity on him. Hopefully not to the extent God will take pity on any one of us and make us God for a week. That's kind of a stimulating thought. But I was going to talk about today the book that the title is derived from, and it's Judith Viorst's book, Necessary Losses. It's an older book. It's been out several years. But this book is a very significant one because it helps any individual in their journey through human life to begin to attach meaning to those up and down experiences that all of us have, all of us would wish not to have. And so the question is whether you're going to enjoy the ride and somehow redeem those experiences. Much as, I guess, remember those of you, many of you look like you're old enough as I am, to remember that ad years ago, the Aqua Velva ad. Remember, you got slapped across the face, and he said, thanks, I needed that. And that's the significance of loss. But that's not the sermon I want to give today. The sermon I want to give today is related to loss, but in a different context. And I want to talk about a young man, 36 years old, named Eric Rudolph. And I want to talk about his world. You may recall Eric Rudolph was apprehended yesterday in the hills of, North Carolina. And he is accused of being behind the bombing of the Atlanta Olympics a number of years ago and of a church and of a healthcare clinic where in each case people were either killed or injured. Now, this is a man who is associated with far-right Christian groups, who has a definite idea of the world he's trying to protect, a world that probably started ceasing to exist in 1900. We not only live in a world, but we are a world, and our worlds are shaped by influences as we grow up. And Eric Rudolph's world is one that is shaped by fundamentalist Christian beliefs. And he not only isn't quite used to modernity, he's not used to post-modernity, which we're entering now. We're not even sure what to call it. We just know what it isn't, post-modernity. And it's a world that is diverse. It's a world that has moved away from categorizing people. It's a world that no longer attaches lesser importance to women and the role of women. And this poor man, along with probably millions of cohorts, are not yet ready to believe that this new world is the one that God is giving sanction to or giving blessing to. And so they're going to fight with all their might to stop that world and to try and tear it down. The losses that these people experience, I saw firsthand when I was pastor in Anaheim, I was chair of the Planned Parenthood Affiliates Board of Directors, 1993 to 1994, and during that time, my church was picketed every Sunday for 14 months. And I didn't have to endure much because I went inside this great big Gothic fortress much earlier than the pickets did. But my parishioners had to endure insults, name-calling, and all kinds of ridicule for my sake because of my involvement with Planned Parenthood by people who were demonstrating in the name of love. And I won't repeat what they said out of love to my parishioners. But my predecessors in Anaheim who built this great big Gothic fortress were far-seeing. They knew the time would come when Presbyterians would have to stand up for something. In fact, it occurred to me after these months of picketing that any church that isn't being picketed, there's something wrong. Why? Because in the conflict of human ideas, there are going to be people who are resentful toward the new age and the new world that is coming. And if you really effectively stand up for that new world, somebody is going to be angry. They're going to be out there picketing. To the day that Unitarians are taken seriously in the world of the U.S. stage, and you are perceived as a threat, you'll know you've come of age. And how will you know? Out there on the sidewalk. Every church should be picketed. And we're picketed by people who are going through a sense of loss, that their world is no longer the world that seems to be gaining ascendancy. And what is that world that is coming of age? It is a world where finally we are letting go some of the ideas about the differences between gender, men and women. You know, I am a student of history, and I always thought, well, we've moved beyond all of those prejudices and problems. I grew up in a liberal Presbyterian congregation in Coronado, California. A minister that I grew up with was well-read. He was in that church for 42 years. He did something. Actually, he just outlived all of the different Navy brass that came and went. Because it's a Navy town, so the congregation changed. But I believe that all of the ideas of the past that pulled people down were really disappearing. But then when I got out in the parish, I realized that those ideas are still insidiously around. Aristotle, one of the great thinkers in history, at least of Western civilization, contributed so much to our way of thinking, but he had some ideas about women that if you knew about him, you'd go out and burn his books. He really believed that women and the gestation period of when they were conceived were more akin to a vegetative state. And they didn't receive a soul till much later. And the women, you really didn't have a mind. They were simply an incubus for human males to pass on the next generation. And you wonder what the magnitude of that idea is in human civilization, in his writings, and it's still present in the churches that refuse to recognize the gifts of ministry of women. Or believe that women should not be heard. Or even in this century, well, last century, when women were refused the vote. We are so close to the prevalence of those ideas. And so the people who demonstrated outside my church in Anaheim were children of Aristotle. Because those powerful ideas are what are shaping our behavior today. Loss, giving up the old, believing the sky is falling. In Planned Parenthood, we still see, it seems, so many changes over the last few years. Think about this. In 1965, a case went to the Supreme Court, Griswold versus the state of Connecticut. This was before Roe v. Wade in 1973. In Connecticut, in that year, it was illegal for married couples to get birth control. That's like 38 years ago, 37 years ago. And why was it illegal? These were married couples who could not get birth control. There was a suspicion, not about the men, oh, of course not, that women, if they had birth control, they would be what? Promiscuous. And with wholesale abandon, they would go out and they would have intercourse and do it all. 1966-67, we believe this. The Supreme Court of the United States struck that down. And that was the beginning of the new consciousness of privacy. that has seen great strides in the California state constitution and even in federal laws, although that is being severely challenged now. Scalia and Thomas don't believe that privacy is a right that is implied in the U.S. Constitution. Actually, in my study of the Bible, it's kind of curious because I've discovered that the Bible has a lot of humor and there's a lot of sabotage going on of even the patriarchal ideas that seem to govern it. For instance, how many of you ever heard of the Daughters of Zelophehad? You should study these ladies. Well, there's not much to study. There's a passing reference in the Torah. Now, what was going on was that while the people of Israel were progressing through the Sinai desert, they had community problems, and one of them was that Zelophehad, a great man, Israelite, he died. That's about all we know about him. He died. And all he had were daughters. And, of course, in a patriarchal civilization, what happens? If you are without a son, you die, then I guess your inheritance goes to the community, to the Levites. These daughters, the daughters of Zelophehad, it says in the Torah, they went to Moses and they said, "This isn't fair." Imagine the guts in doing that. Well, Moses could have said many things. He probably was still a patriarchal type. I mean, just look what happened to Miriam. She probably was a great feminist leader in that community, but we don't know much about her. And for her challenging Moses, what happened? She was turned into a leper. We need a gospel according to Miriam. That would be a story. But anyway, Moses, he got this request, and he could have just said, denied. But what did he do? He didn't know. He admitted he didn't know. Isn't that something for a man? And he said, you know what? I've got to consult the Lord. A lot of ministers do this still. And in a very terse statement, he consulted the Lord, and what did the Lord say? Give them the inheritance. The daughters of Zelophehad. It didn't change the statute books, but it was one little opening. In the New Testament, there's a lot of humor. For instance, have you ever thought about who discovered the empty tomb? The Gospels record a different picture than, say, St. Paul, and his has the earliest writings. He says that Peter and the others discovered the empty tomb. But the Gospels make clear that who discovered the empty tomb? Women. Now, this is kind of curious. And can you figure out why? Well, in the society of that time, women didn't have a leg to stand on. They were not witnesses. They could not be witnesses to anything because they couldn't take an oath. And you know why they couldn't take an oath? They couldn't testify. And to put it kind of obliquely, they didn't have the necessary equipment to testify. I hope I don't have to be more graphic than that. You may recall that in ancient patriarchal culture, ancient Israel, that when you took an oath, and in the Hebrew, the euphemism is you put your hand on your thigh. It isn't the thigh to put the hand on. You were swearing on your progeny. You were swearing before God that if you did not keep your word, a part of your anatomy would dry up and you would have no children. It was kind of a graphic way to make an oath. Not quite the same what we do in the courts of the United States where you put your hand on a Bible. Yeah. Well, women couldn't do this. The word testify in English echoes that. You have to have a certain article to testify. And if you don't have that, you can't testify. So the testimony, the witness of the early Christian movement is based on what? Women who don't have a leg, or anything else for that matter, to stand on. Now, don't you think God has a sense of humor? Well, you see, they just couldn't come out and say this. They had to evoke a response by the nature of the literature, which left an impression that the world was changing. And the Christian movement in the beginning was an egalitarian movement where women and slaves and the dispossessed and those in the lowest levels of society had the same say as those who previously were on the upper echelons. And they pointed to this new reality they believed they saw in Christ. Well, of course, St. Paul saw the same thing, even though he was kind of a curmudgeon male in some ways. But he pointed that when he said, in Christ there is no East or West, no Jew or Gentile, no free or slave. We are all one. Those old boundaries have dissolved. But what happened in the generations after St. Paul? The hierarchical nature of the growing Christian movement decided that bishops and pastors should be male. They should have one wife. They should be of this temperament, they should be of that behavior, and so the beginnings of the Christian movement were eviscerated. When I graduated from Princeton Seminary, I had all the answers. Princeton encourages that. You remember, there was a time in your life when you had all the answers. You knew everything. And God sees that and decides now is the time to take that clay and begin having some fun with it. Descendant of Cotton Mather, even more answers. So I remember an early part of my ministry, I had, within a short period of time, this was not long after the Roe versus Wade decision, a couple of young women would come to me and ask, Pastor, what do you think about abortion? They had a friend that was contemplating an abortion. It's always a friend, isn't it? Well, of course, I descended into my pontifical knowledge of God's will, which I was so perfectly endowed with. And I said, well, it's a difficult thing, but God means for every life to be born and this and on and on and on and on, which, of course, is sort of silly since half of pregnancies probably end in miscarriage. I mean, the anti-choice people in I at that time didn't need to think about that. But what happens to all of those lives that don't seem to bear fruition? What does God do with that? So he has to believe somehow, eventually, in the providence of God, to take over where we can't know. Well, anyway, I had some kind of answer about this. The trouble was I wasn't worrying much about the question. And after these two women, in a short period of time, went away and I thought about it, I realized... Even with my Princeton education and my Mather pedigree, something happened, and I realized this was not just a distant cerebral question. This was a real painful experience for them. They were probably either contemplating an abortion or most likely already had the abortion. And they were looking for some justification for this. And they came to a pastor. Who better able to dispense the mercy and the love of God? But what did I dispense? Well, I think I was just mealy-mouthed, a little of this and a little of that, no clear focus. But I doubt that they heard the mercy of God showing through. For me, a world had to come crashing down. A world of preconceptions, definite parameters of what is right and what is wrong. I had to grow and learn and mature, and like a good wine, age finally began to have its say. So I suppose in the fullness of the way things work out, I ended up involved with Planned Parenthood. Now I sit on its national board. And life is a lot more fluid and ambiguous. And now if I were to meet those young women or probably their daughters, I would have a different answer. Because the key now, I think, real maturity enables one to enter into a world not necessarily with firm answers, but like Jesus of Nazareth or other great religious leaders, to go to the core of where the ambiguity of life hits the road, and you simply show your compassion and your love. Today, I think each of us is called in a very difficult world to embrace a new world that is not yet fully on the horizon. We see injustice, we see war, we see lack of sensitivity. But we are to exhibit qualities that show confidence that the future that we are helping to bring into reality, that we trust God is bringing into reality, will be one that is both compassionate, maybe ultimately to those who are having trouble at losing the old world. The old world that is very certain. The world of the protesters outside my church. The world of Mr. Rudolph and others like him, who can't quite get it together, who can justify killing in the name of love, bombing in the name of truth. What do we say to that? We can condemn it. We can feel a little proud that we are not like that. Perhaps ultimately we have to try to enter their world and find the way to communicate with them, as I have at times with protesters outside my church. Most of the time it's a hopeless cause. But every so often I would go out and I would converse with them. One time the church even took out punch and cookies. They were nervous about the punch and the cookies. They remembered Jim Jones. That testified to some kind of love, didn't it? To be called a blankety-blank, oh, here. Maybe that's what we're called to do. When somebody flips you off on the highway, say, go ahead, take your place. Turn the other cheek. Actually, you know, I have tried doing that. It really is a lot more fun to return evil for evil. But it is an amazingly resurgent sense of sovereignty when you can resist being sucked into their world of chaos. Try it. Go out there and wait for that moment. It's out there. Get on the freeway today. That's your homework. And wait to be cut off and turn and smile to them and say, go ahead. Remember, using all your fingers. Not one way, and not victory, or whatever else. That is a new world that I think we're called to emulate. Is the sky falling? Is Chicken Little right? I don't think so. There are those who are filled with fear all around us, and it is our task to show a different way, with different behavior, and ultimate confidence that God's will prevail. Amen.